Christopher Lydon. Listen up. In Ralph Nader's considered post-election opinion, it was the big media and the nasty New York Times in particular that were the real spoilers of campaign 2000. When Ralph wanted to talk about a democracy gap in America, the media couldn't see him beyond the Gore-Bush horse race. When Ralph wanted to talk about hard news like farm policy, a living wage, reporters gave him the feature story treatment. Nader says he never reached the American public because the American press doesn't know how to cover third-party reform. What Ralph Nader has to explain is why he didn't see a policy gap between the two-party contenders. 75 days into Bush 2, lots of people are shocked and unhappy at the return of the Cold War, the deregulation of arsenic in their drinking water, and the paving of trackless national forests. It would still help, Ralph Nader says, to put his issues at the center of an open debate. What he calls his untold story is next, as the conversation continues. Audio streaming provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting came from Elsa Dorfman, Boston's Matthew Brady. Details available at elsa.photo.net. And from Harvey Silverglate, co-author of The Shadow University, The Betrayal of Liberty on America's Campuses, now in paperback from Harper Perennial Books. And from Pagito Systems Group, specializing in Java and Linux-based multi-tier application development, www.pagito.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. Ralph Nader says his run for the presidency was maybe the greatest story never told in election 2000. His campaign memoir notes that he couldn't get the Washington Post across the street for his announcement press conference, and the New York Times called him clutter on the big boys' playing field. The Times could barely rouse its interest even when Nader filled Madison Square Garden with one of his super rallies. When he wanted to talk about hard news, environmental policy, the drug wars, foreign policy, reporters who knew and respected him looked away. But Ralph Nader has to answer for, especially as the young Bush administration turns right, is the view that there were no real differences between the major party candidates last year. Were we warned about spy wars with the Russians, about rising, not calming, tensions with North Korea, about this relaxed view of arsenic in our drinking water? Or were those, in fact, the sorts of issues that Ralph Nader might have dragged into those dull Gore-Bush debates last fall? Has he defaulted his position in our political debates? Or is the problem that Ralph Nader hasn't been included? Our phone is 617-450-2923. Ralph Nader joins us from Washington. His critic, the New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis, joins us from Boston. Lance Morrow of Time Magazine, Tom Edsel of The Washington Post, Chris Matthews of Hardball will join us a little bit later. Give them a call at 617-450-2923. Ralph, how should the big boys have covered you, and how did they?
Well, they covered our campaign largely as occasional features, even though they were accusing us of affecting the margin between Bush and Gore, even though we had record rallies far larger than the major candidates, even though we had an agenda that discussed very important issues that the press had been reporting on outside of the campaign over last few years, like corporate crime and corporate welfare and the lack of labor rights to form trade unions as Western democracies have, or living wage, or consumer protection, or the declaration that it's time, not step by step, but to get universal health care, and the overriding horrible problem of endemic poverty in our country, the miserable record of the Clinton administration on civil liberties, and their little publicized low rate of litigation involving civil rights violations in the country, the bloated military budget,
one after another. The agenda was there.
In other words, we weren't injecting extraneous issues that had not been discussed by some of the major media over the years. It just resulted in the major media not wanting to discuss it in the context of our campaign. And, of course, being excluded from the presidential debates by this corporation known as the Presidential Debate Commission, run by the two parties and funded by corporations, prevented us from reaching tens of millions of voters.
At critical times, you didn't have the poll numbers that made you a real threat to win the race. Whose fault was that?
Well, that's a catch-22. You know, you don't get the media, you don't get the polls. You don't get the polls, you don't get the media. I mean, that's an old story. chronicled many times. The important thing here is that did we have a credible campaign in terms of the people wanting us on the debates? Yes, the polls overwhelmingly said they wanted Buchanan and me on the president's debate. Were we on most of the state ballots, even though there are some terrible hurdles, such as North Carolina? Yes, we were on 45 state ballots. Did we have a record over 35, 40 years of involvement and achievement? Yes, we did that. The press just doesn't know how to cover third-party movements unless you have somebody like Ross Perot, of course, whose billions of dollars loom over the horizon.
What about Pat Buchanan?
What about him?
How similar was his predicament to yours?
Well, he was on most states, too, and he was very busy in this internecine struggle within the Reform Party, and that took away from some of the interest of the press. But he wasn't covered as a news beat either. Of course, he came in very, very low in the polls, but he was on most of the state ballots, and of course he ran better 4 years and 8 years earlier.
Anthony Lewis, I'd like to ask you, because you and the editorial page of the New York Times both sort of encouraged voters, readers, and other media to ignore the Nader campaign. Why wouldn't it have been a better race for that third party independent-minded challenge?
I don't think I encourage the media to ignore Ralph. I don't have that power, and I didn't attempt it. I was critical of his getting into the race because I thought it might have the effect it did have, to be a very significant contributing factor to the defeat of Gore, especially in Florida, where Ralph made a visit in the last week of the campaign and won 97,000 votes, 10 times more than necessary for Gore to win Florida and the race, and we would not now be seeing rules suspended by Bush that require government contractors to obey the law. We wouldn't see the removal of the energy saving rules and a suspension of a myriad of environmental rules, all of which Ralph Nader is for, and in significant part because of his dogged and egomaniacal campaign are now being undone. So I thought it was a bad idea for him to run. I still think so. Now,
But he did run, and it wasn't for you or anybody else to tell him he couldn't.
No,
why not put him in the center stage of that debate and let him make it more interesting, as Ross Perot surely made the Bush-Clinton debates more interesting?
Yeah, I think that is a more interesting question, and it's a fair question, and it's one that Ralph raised in Brill's content fairly enough. There is, as he said there, a catch-22 about getting media attention in a campaign. You don't get the attention unless you have the attention, unless you have a big showing of support first, and it is a catch-22, but I'm afraid it's explainable, it's explicable. The election in this country, for good or ill, and I'm inclined to agree with Ralph that it's for ill, is not mostly about issues of the kind that he just listed so compellingly, but about the two candidates. And that's the way people vote, and that's what counts in the end. And somebody who was at his most hopeful, aiming for 5% of the vote, is not significant in that regard, and is, or at least is not regarded as significant by the people who decide what goes into newspapers and what newspapers cover. Perot is different because he started out with 20 or 25% of the vote, and he ended up with a very significant proportion of the vote as compared to the small showing that Ralph Nader made. And that's true of Teddy Roosevelt when he ran on the Bull Moose Party, and it was true of the progressives in their day, or Henry Wallace or Strom Thurmond in their day. They all had, they won electoral votes. They mattered. And
are you saying there's no Ralph Nader base out there? I mean, he did do things with big rallies that the major candidates could never have done, I think.
Well, that's true. Those are interesting, but they did. But they're not really about affecting the election, except in the state where it mattered, which was Florida, and maybe one or two other states. But you know, when you end up, I've forgotten what Ralph's figure was—3%, something like that. That doesn't matter what rally you have in Portland or New York City, in the end, you don't really command a significant part of the vote.
Ralph Nader.
Well, you know, the catch-22 comes back into the dialogue here. Do third parties have a chance to have a chance? They confront massive statutory barriers in about a dozen states. North Carolina now requires 58,000 verified signatures, and they pick at them, so you got to get about 1,000. You got to give it 100,000 just to qualify. All kinds of technical ways that can disqualify voters, including the color of the paper in a particular county. And that's true in states like Texas and Oklahoma, Indiana, Illinois. That's one hurdle. The second hurdle is that the major parties command most of the money. They command most of the media. They command the polls as a result. They exclude competitors from the debates. If two major parties in France or England or Italy played that game, excluded third parties, funded their debate commission with corporate money, we would ridicule them in terms of the way they're manipulating the electorate. And, of course, they start out with 30% hereditary Democrats and roughly 30% hereditary Republicans. So what's the message to competitors here? The message is step aside because you're going to affect one candidate who's not as bad as another. And so the criticism that the Times and others directed toward our campaign was really rooted in a basic principle, which is step aside. You may have a constitutional right to run, but you shouldn't run, because this is a two-party country. And of course, in nature can't regenerate itself if it snuffs out seeds from sprouting. In the business world, it couldn't regenerate itself without letting entrepreneurs and innovators compete under the antitrust laws. But apparently in a two-party duopoly, which has increasingly degraded American politics and increasingly converged more and more on the issues of corporate power dominating our elections and government, I guess it's okay to pursue a policy in public commentary to say to third parties, you know, unless you start out with 15-20% or so, get out of the way.
Tony
Lewis. Perot was at 6% just before he got on the major debates, and he shot up much higher when he got on the debates in 1992. But there wasn't a 15% barrier against him, the way this corporation called the Debate Commission erected against us after collecting money from Philip Morris and Anheuser-Busch, Ford, and AT&T. The whole process is a corrupt, exclusionary process, and it degrades and undermines our democratic health.
Is it okay, Tony Lewis?
Well, I think it's a bit unworthy of Ralph to suggest that Anheuser-Busch and Philip Morris are dictating the result of the debate commission. That's unworthy of you, Ralph. It's just silly. But I happen to agree.
It doesn't bother you, Tony, that it's corporate funded, and they have all these gatherings and all these quid pro quos and meetings around the debates between corporations and politicians?
No, that doesn't bother me.
It doesn't bother you?
If you let me finish, I'll tell you that I happen to agree with you, Ralph, about the debates. I think you should have been included. I also enthusiastically agree with you about ballot access. I think it's an outrage that you have to get 100,000 signatures in North Carolina and so on. I think that's an extremely important point, and I entirely agree with you. But your general argument, it seems to me, it should be made to the Constitution of the United States. We don't have a political system of the kind that exists in France or Italy, where small parties can come in. We have and incidentally, they can't on the whole in Britain, because they also have a political system that's tilted the other way. We have a constitutional system that for 200 years has favored two parties. That's the system. And, you know, it has faults, and I think the issues you raise are important, but it happens that under our constitutional system, they have to be raised within the two parties.
Historically, third parties have played a very good role. Abolitionist Party, Women's Suffrage Party, Union Labor Party.
But those weren't parties that ran in elections. Abolitionists didn't run against Lincoln and cause Douglas to be elected, or some reactionary Southerner, which is what you did. They were a movement which gradually changed the political system and made the Republican Party an abolitionist party.
Well, I beg your pardon. I mean, the former populist progressive movement fielded presidential, senatorial, gubernatorial candidates. The Labor Party did the same thing. But in Canada, they have a winner-take-all system in Canada. Why did they allow five-party representatives running for prime minister a few months ago on the national debates, because they don't have this kind of corporatist debate commission run by the two parties to exclude competitors.
Well, I've said I agree with you about the debate, but I still say, and history certainly makes it clear, that we have constitutionally, for constitutional reasons, for good or ill, a two-party system in this country. That's what we have, and the third parties make briefly arise and fall away, and they may have an effect internally on the major parties, but they don't win elections.
Well, let me ask you, Tony, when can a third party, in your view, that's on the progressive end, ever run presidential candidates, since you will agree that the Democrats will always be seen as not as bad as the Republicans? I mean, do we wait another 4 years, as Phil Donahue said, and ask the two parties, please, can we run now? And are you worried about the fact that George W. Bush got 10 times more Democratic votes in Florida than I did? Are you blaming him? In other words, let's focus on when, if ever, what are the conditions under which a progressive new third party could run a presidential candidacy?
I don't think we have them in this country, but for the reason I've already stated, because the Constitution so strongly favors two parties. That's just the system we have. I'm simply talking about the futility of it, Ralph, not the abstract desirability of it. I say if the result is to give us a president who undoes things you care deeply about, there's got to be something wrong with following that course.
But, Tony, could I ask if the system, and a lot of people observed it, tends toward a duopoly, a sort of a two-party game that protects the insiders from all the outsiders. What are the countervailing measures that media, that columnists even, newspapers, debate organizers have to take to stir the pot?
Well, that's a good question. I'm rather in despair about that. I don't know what we can do. Part of the problem is, you put it, the duopoly. The districting of the House of Representatives has been computerized to such a fine art that it's practically impossible to change the result of most elections for the House. And you're going to have a House that's in which the two parties are separated by a small number of seats for as far as into the future as you can look, barring some great change in the actual political condition in the country. When Barry Goldwater ran for president after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the political condition in the country produced an overwhelmingly Democratic Congress. And that could happen either way. But generally speaking, I think we're in for a time of closely balanced races. The country is divided, and that's the way it's going to be.
Tony Lewis, I'd like... Hang on one sec. I want to ask Tony Lewis, as a decorated newsman, and also Lance Morrow, who joins us in the studio, Time magazine, to consider the newsworthiness test that Ralph put to editors around the country, basically asking them sort of what does a third party candidate have to do, you know, short of murder or running naked through the public square, to be considered a provocative piece of news. We all know the adage of the news business is, you know, dog bites man, that's not news. Man bites dog, that's news. What does a third party candidate have to do? Where does he have to stand in the polls? What does he have to say? What does he have to have done earlier in life? How many Nobels or professorships or state elections does he have to win to be interesting to the news media? Tony Lewis.
Well, you've just in a way said it, Chris. I don't sound very idealistic when I answer your questions as I do. I don't feel very idealistic because I'm stuck with reality. You know, you said professor or Nobel Prize winner. Well, I mean, I wouldn't give him any space. Professor X announces he has a better system for running this country than the established politicians and he's going to run. Would you give him news? I wouldn't, because he's not in the game. You know, it's all very well, but it's not relevant. I think it would be a good idea, I personally believe it would be a good idea, to have paid more attention to Ralph Nader's ideas and the issues that he raised. But there's no escaping from this catch-22, there we go again, of not being really in the game unless you are in the game, unless you can show that you have a level of support that justifies treating you as a serious competitor, someone who is likely to win a significant number of popular and even electoral votes as a candidate on his own.
You see, the logic of that basically reserves the political scene in this country to two parties. I beg to differ with Tony. The Constitution doesn't say anything about a two-party system. It has a winner-take-all system. Two parties are not even mentioned in the Constitution.
True.
To ascribe to the Constitution this kind of inevitability that we're left with just two major parties is, I think, too great a concession to reality. Tony Lewis doesn't concede reality when he engages in brilliant column after brilliant column attacking the assault on civil liberties by the Clinton-Gore administration. I don't agree, Tony, you can get away with this by simply saying you're stuck with reality. Your whole career has been to elevate constitutional principles into practice that have been too long ignored.
Well, Ralph, that's a wonderfully kind thing for you to say, and I know you've said similar things publicly, and I'm extremely grateful for it. Of course, the two-party system is not in the Constitution. Parties arose rather shortly afterward, somewhat to the surprise of the framers. But the way the Constitution is written has produced that system, even though it's not in there. And that's why we've had two major parties through all our history, but because it's the structure is such that it is has always been very hard for an outside force to get in. And you may deplore that, and I might think it was more interesting if we had a multi-party system like Italy, but then there would be prices to pay the other way. And that's what I mean by reality. Reality is, I think, that if you want to get your issues heard, they have to be done within the Democratic Party, because you're not going to be elected president, and you're not going to have a good effect on the outcome.
Well, two answers to that. One is the Republican Party did it in 6 years. They got pretty good coverage from 1854 to 1816. Of course, there was a big issue, slavery, that was in the mix there.
Yes.
But, you see, I don't understand why you understand that the Constitution did facilitate, with the cooperation of the press and vigorous candidates and so forth, the emergence of a third party into a major second party, number one. And why suddenly in the 21st century people should be realistic and just marginalize third party candidates? You know, it's harder to go from 0 to 5% than to go from 5 to 10, harder to go from 5 to 10% than 10 to 15%. It's not out of the range that after a few election cycles, a third party can begin to be a major player, if it has a chance to have a chance. But the real untold story in this country is we really don't have a two-party system in most congressional districts and in most states. The Democratic Party dominates certain districts. Republican parties either don't contend or just have nominal candidates, and the Republican Party dominates certain districts, and about 90% of the House of Representatives congressional districts are one-party districts.
Yeah.
So there, the problem is even worse than a two-party situation.
Well, of course, I said that earlier, so of course I agree with you, and I deplore it. I deplore it. But I don't think you can show any example since the Republican Party's emergence under the extraordinary circumstances that you mentioned, the slavery issue, the Civil War. You can't show any example of a third party turning into a major party with, for more than one election. It just doesn't seem to work that way.
Tony, I want to come back on one thing that Ralph hasn't responded to. That is, you say, you know, it would have been good to pay attention to his issues, but not for him to run. But we all know that when people, you know, carry on about issues from the sideline, people say, well, come on, get in, get onto the playing field, take a number, run for office. And people certainly said that to Ralph Nader over the many years when he didn't run. Aren't you condemning him, his issues, one way or the other?
Let me just give an example of how I think an issue has to be dealt with. And it's a very difficult issue, as difficult as any of the other ones that Ralph has discussed, and that is drugs. I regard the drug war policy in this country as terrible and cruel, unjust, and self-defeating. Very few national politicians have been willing to look seriously at what the drug war has done to this country and how much it has harmed this country and how self-defeating it has been. But gradually, in state after state, with the leadership of people like the governor of New Mexico and a few members of other leaders, the issue is taking hold. I think that's a much more effective way of dealing with that extremely hard issue, because it's so easy to say you're in favor of drug lords and all that. much more effective way of dealing with it than for a third-party presidential candidate to have it on his list of issues. I just think it doesn't work that way.
Well, see, this raises a very important function of third parties. Even if they don't win the national races, and they do win local races, and that's where the Green Party, I think, will have more of its success. 15% of its candidates at the local level won on this first round, and that's the way you build it from the bottom up. But Tony mentioned the drug war. The drug issues were not issues debated by Bush and Gore. They didn't do it on the campaign. They didn't do it during the presidential debates, and they weren't really pressed by Jim Lehrer to do it. Now, the governor of New Mexico has taken a courageous stand, and I had a press conference with him as a third-party candidate, and we elaborated these issues that Tony has raised about the failed war on drugs to an even larger audience. So in terms of two functions, one is to elaborate issues that the two-party candidates and parties are ignoring, and secondly, to push one or more of the two-party candidates, the way Perot pushed them on the deficit, in a better direction. These are very important functions of third parties, but they have to have some sort of decent news media coverage other than carping about how it's going to affect the two big guys or doing occasional features. So it isn't just are you going to win or not, it's are you building something where years later someone may win with a new party, and second, do you elaborate issues and associate these issues that are courageously portrayed by conventional politicians of the two parties, like the governor of New Mexico? And third, do you push, as third parties have so prominently in our history, one of the two major parties in the right direction? All that has a very high utility. And I don't think the news media recognizes that sufficiently, even though they will be the first to tell you they're bored silly, covering redundant, tepid campaigns day after day, and the old symbolism of the boys on the bus.
Chris, if I may have a last word I have to go. I'd say that I was in agreement with most of what Ralph just said. And I had said earlier that I'd like it if the papers would pay more attention to issues, and the issues particularly that Ralph raises. But there is something you can't escape from. Sure, we're over concerned with the horse race. We always have been, the press. But there it is. It's a horse race. And somebody, either Gore or Bush, one or the other major party candidates, is going to win. And you can't get away from the impact of a third party candidate on that outcome. And the impact in this case was, ironically, to set back the concerns that Ralph Nader has advanced, and you just can't escape.
Do you accept that, Ralph? Do you accept that if trees are cut in the pristine forest of Alaska, that they ought to be named? The stump should be renamed in your honor because you elected George W. Bush.
What Tony didn't recognize in that column is that these trees have been cut under Reagan, Bush, Clinton. The Tongass Forest has lost a lot of trees. They weren't waiting for George W. Bush. The second thing I think is important is, even in a horse race, the news media pays attention to the jockeying of other horses who aren't necessarily in the front as the mix changes down the stretch. So just to take that analogy a little further, even when there is just a two-horse race, there are other horses that affect the dynamic of that race from the get-go. I think Gore won the election. It was stolen from him. The democratically controlled counties in South Florida betrayed him. They didn't recount the votes. Dade County didn't recount them at all, and Palm Beach missed the deadline by 2 hours after having taken off Thanksgiving, deadline set by a relatively friendly Supreme Court of Florida. So I guess the Green Party has to be accused of not helping Gore win more victoriously. I think...
Ralph Nader, stand by. There are also horses that could be called for bumping in the backstretch that can affect the race significantly without winning it. We're talking with the Green Party candidate last year, Ralph Nader, who says that the real spoilers in the race weren't him, they were the big media. We'll be back with Lance Morrow of Time Magazine and Tom Edsel of The Washington Post. Thank you to Anthony Lewis. Stand by, Ralph Nader. We'll be back. The phone 617-450-2923. Audio streaming provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting came from the poet Gail Mazur, whose fourth collection, They Can't Take That Away From Me, has just been published by the University of Chicago Press, available at Amazon.com. And from Suzanne and Bob Petrucci and Will Creeley at www.campusgreenparties.org. And from Kathy Callahan of West Roxbury, Massachusetts, Attention Deficit Disorder Coaching, Tutoring, and Counseling. Born to Rush at AOL.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. The conversation continues. We're talking about Ralph Nader, who in Brill's Content magazine this month argues that his own presidential race was the great untold story of election 2000. Give him a call at 617-450-2923. How do you cover a third-party candidate who probably is not going to win? What is the standard? Lance Morrow writes wise commentary in Time magazine. Tom Edsel writes for the Washington Post, politics especially. I put it to you guys, what is the newsworthy test of a presidential candidate who's not going to win? Lance Morrow.
Well, I guess it's a question I would turn around and put to Mr. Nader. It's not clear to me what he considers to be the criteria by which an editor should decide whether or not to assign a correspondent full-time to a third-party campaign, other than the fact that he considers his issues to be vitally important to the country, as in the case of Mr. Nader, I do as well. But it's a very difficult call. In before, during, and after every presidential campaign, you always have great head-scratching and soul-searching in every news organization in the country. How should we cover this? How should we be covering? What did we do wrong in covering this? It's not entirely clear to me that Mr. Nader was as neglected as he feels in the campaign just passed. It seems to me that there was good deal of coverage of his issues and of his candidacy.
What is the standard that news executives have reached after all these years? I mean, as long as I've been around, they sort of lash themselves for this horse race thing and do it again.
Yeah. Well, to begin with, I think I may be repeating a point that Tony Lewis made. I do not regard it as entirely reprehensible to cover a horse race. I think it is a horse race, and I think that you've got Mr. Nader is an admirable horse, but you've got other horses, and one of them is going to come in first and be president. I don't think it's anything inherently wrong in covering a horse race. However, and also I think a lot of the coverage of the issues tends to be a little foolish and overdone and neglects the fact that in the midst of a campaign, campaign promises, for example, may not have any relationship to the reality that will come after the administration takes office. So there's a certain fog effect that is introduced into a campaign by elaborate but very worthy coverage of the issues. But I think that you cannot state precisely what the standard is for any managing editor, any news organization.
One of the standards came to be known for Bob Shogan of the Los Angeles Times, who covered a lot of these campaigns, was that that the candidate that the reporters really like and respect is going to get screwed in the coverage and surely in the counting of the votes. That a candidate who says as many of the kinds of things that Ralph Nader does, who is a bit of a reporter himself, who has fed reporters insight and scoops over the years, is never going to get by some perverse
I don't rule. Quite get the logic of that. I mean,
it's an anti-logical observation.
But in my experience, going back many years to, for example, the coverage of Bobby Kennedy's campaign in the spring of 1968, I mean, correspondents who fell in love with the Kennedys were regularly a problem for news organizations. They had to say, well, wait, are they getting too close? Is he getting too close to, you know, to Bobby? And there was a very close relationship there, and certainly the Kennedys.
The Kennedys are a separate category. I'm talking about the kinds of sort of critical, ironic, well-informed candidates that reporters tend to see as one of their own. I mean,
I don't quite get.
Well, I'm thinking of Bruce Babbitt, for example, John Gilligan of Ohio. There's a certain kind of Paul Tsongas was another one. People with a kind of critical, independent intelligence never make it big as presidential candidates. The reporters are always disappointed in a sense, and part of that.
Well, I would go back again. Forgive me to '68 and say Eugene McCarthy, who was skeptical, cool, critical. You know, and with whom many.
Yes, he had those writerly qualities.
And he had an enormous. He didn't, after all, win New Hampshire that year, but he made a very impressive, showing and. And he had a very good
Well, that's a digression, and we won't linger on it. Tom Edsel, what's the newsworthiness test for a third party candidate? Does big media know how to cover an interesting outsider?
Well, I mean, you can always say big media doesn't know what it's doing, but I think a candidate has to show that they are mobilizing a significant part of the electorate and that they have a message that is capturing a segment of the vote that is felt either underrepresented or is seeking another alternative to the two candidates that are there.
So how did Ralph score on those measures, mobilizing a constituency and having a worthy message?
Very mezzo mezzo. May I get in here at all?
Sure, please, Ralph.
No, we don't allow Ralph in because he.
Because I can't affect the outcome of the discussion. In response to Mr. Morrow, I think if you did a measurement, I got less than 1% of the column inches or television news time. And my polls for a while hovered at around 5%. Sometimes they went to 6-7, depending on the polling organization. They were higher in some states, like Oregon and Connecticut, and lower in other states. So it was on the screen. We did get the largest crowds around the country, and they weren't bussed in by labor unions or otherwise pre-prepared. We had an agenda that even the press recognizes was unique and important and ignored by the two candidates. For example, Time Magazine's cover on corporate welfare in November 1998 was a terrific job by Bartlett and Steele, and we were talking corporate welfare all over the country. So it isn't like it's off in some moonscape issue, and we were constantly accused of affecting the margin outcome of the two major candidates. And then you add a record of 35 or so years of work in Washington and around the country on these issues on my part. So I think, you know, even by the standards of the press themselves, they did undercover us, and they treated us largely as a feature, as an occasional feature, with about three exceptions.
I wanted to ask you, what were the exceptions, Ralph?
The Fort Worth paper was one exception. A website was another exception. And the Hartford Courant was an exception. They covered us for 2 weeks running as a news beat.
You said that in Brill's content that Tim Russert, who's considered to be, you know, he's a smart guy, did well by you. So did Chris Matthews.
Yes, the cable really, because they have so much time to fill,
and they want excitement. They did cover. I mean, I don't have any complaints about the invitations from Meet the Press or some of the cable shows, especially Chris Matthews and some of the other cable shows. But, you know, those are very small audiences. And a lot of times people like Maria Shriver would call up and say, would you do this at the Philadelphia Republican Convention? I'd say yes. And it would be, the impression would be at NBC, and she would try to get on NBC, but ends up with MSNBC. So these are relatively small audiences.
Stand by for our big, wise, interesting, provocative audience. The phone is 617-450-2923. We're arguing Ralph Nader's case that he was grossly undercovered by the big media. They're the real spoilers in Campaign 2000, he argues. 617-450-2923. Bob is calling from North Acton, Massachusetts.
Hey there.
Welcome, Bob.
You know, everyone's taking a lot of responsibility for the press and their weaknesses in all this. As someone who's was very interested in the Nader campaign and followed it and thought about it a lot, I just would like to say that I think that probably there's some stuff to go around. It struck me by the end of the campaign that the running for president had done to Ralph Nader what it does to so many other people, that is, make them sort of liars. It was a good and sensible point that Gore and Bush were too close together, but as we now see every day, it was a complete and irresponsible exaggeration that they were pretty much exactly the same. And I guess I want to suggest another possibility for how history might have gone in the last few weeks of this campaign that would have addressed a lot of these things. With a week to go, you know, instead of going off as Nader did to Florida to campaign, he could have gone on TV and everyone would have covered it and said, if you live in the following six or seven states, I hope you'll vote for Al Gore. I think if he'd done that, A, we'd have Al Gore as president, B, we'd have Ralph Nader as kingmaker, and C, we'd have these issues he cares about high on the radar screen. That's what we would have been talking about when we were nominating an attorney general, not John Ashcroft.
Ralph Nader, did you think about it?
Well, when you're trying to build a long-term political movement, you don't undermine yourself that way with your followers. You have to consider who is running on the ticket with you, who's working their heads off. You don't play that game. That's what feeds the cynicism of the public.
I don't think this would have been, people would have thought this was cynical at all. I think people would have thought it was smart. I think what you've done is make sure that no one's going to vote for a third party on the left for a long time just for fear that what happened now will happen again in the future.
Well, put yourself in a candidate's place. You go on TV and say, vote for me in Texas, but don't vote for me in Wisconsin. I mean, I'll just leave it at that, but I want to reply to your...
It would have been different, you know, but that's what you're supposedly about.
No, first of all, that assumes that there would be any coverage of it. But anyway, the point you make about the difference, I said there were few major differences between the two candidates. If it was morphed by whoever into saying there were no differences, that's not what I said. But in the area of foreign policy, in the area of a bloated military budget, in the area of soft on corporate crime, fraud, and abuse, turning their backs on living wages, etc., the Republicans and the Democrats, in what they actually do, in contrast to their differing rhetoric, are converging more and more, and the similarities between them tower over the dwindling real differences that they're willing to fight for. The Democrats talk good about labor, but they really haven't pushed their muscle to repeal Taft-Hartley and to do all the things that when they had control of the Congress that they could have done. And of course, it was the Republicans, the Democrats, who took the lead on GATT and NAFTA. So you have to ask yourself, in addition to whatever dwindling real differences in fact there are, you have to ask yourself, what are the similarities in further entrenching concentrated corporate power and wealth over our political economy, elections, democracy, and government? You know, the fact that Clinton laid a trap for Bush by issuing all these dozen or so good regulations after the election, sometimes just before he left office, like the ergonomics standard, these standards were able to be issued months ago, years ago. The ergonomic standard was ready, according to the OSHA physicians, in 1995. So why didn't he issue them before, when they could have been entrenched, they couldn't have been suspended and delayed, because of the political cowardliness of the Democratic Party, not wanting to offend their contributors.
Stand by for callers. The phone's 617-450-2923. Matthew is calling from Davis, California.
Hi.
Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you. Well, I just want to say a couple things. I find it very frustrating that, the previous caller and Anthony Lewis are badgering Ralph Nader on issues that, you know, I think just don't apply right now. I think if you ask the same old questions, you're going to get the same old answers, and we're just not going to progress. You know, I mean, I think Ralph Nader is trying to do something here, and he, you know, has a lot of knowledge, and he should be listened to. I mean, I think, you know, if we keep covering the same old ground, we're just going to...
Break the new ground, Matthew. Go ahead.
Sure. Okay. Okay, my question for Ralph Nader is, how is the lawsuit against the Commission on Presidential Debates progressing, and do you foresee a favorable outcome?
We survived a motion to dismiss, so we're now in depositions. This is the lawsuit against the debate commission, which I believe unlawfully excluded me from the premises of the University of Massachusetts, where I had an invitation to sit in an auditorium next to the debate auditorium in preparation for an invitation from Fox News for commentary after the debate was concluded. The grounds, of course, of violation of civil rights. There's another lawsuit against the debate commission alleging that the corporate contributions of the debate commission were unlawful under the 1907 Tillman Act. We lost that at the district court level in Boston. It's now on appeal.
Okay. I have a few other questions. Have you talked with Al Gore since the election? And if so, what was said? And also, what is your opinion of Al Gore right now?
No, I haven't talked to him. I think Al Gore should start speaking out. He's the titular head of the party. He thinks he did win the election. If he's so upset about what Bush is doing, how can he remain silent? This is a custom that some defeated candidates have pursued in our country's history, and I don't think it's a very good custom. It undermines what they're allegedly supposed to be building, a stronger Democratic Party, and taking a stand on the issues that he cares about.
Also,
go for it, Matthew.
What's that?
I said, go for it. Your turn.
Okay. How did your meeting with Hillary Clinton go at the Gridiron Roast?
She canceled a month before. She declined the invitation by Newsday to attend the Gridiron Club a month before the event.
Was that because of you or just because she didn't want to go?
I have no idea.
Okay. Politicians in general, i.e. Al Gore and Hillary Clinton, are so canned and scripted. It is clear that they are presenting a fake public persona, but are thinking and doing things much differently privately. From your experiences with them, what are they really like? Do you have any personal anecdotes of interactions you've had with them?
Well, no, I don't interact that much with them, but from closely observing them, I would think that their knowledge races way ahead of their ability to apply that knowledge. And so Gore knows a lot about the environment, but he didn't do much for pushing a national mission for renewable energy. He didn't do much for bringing the auto companies up to higher fuel efficiency standards. In fact, he and Clinton gave him an 8-year holiday. So that's what's so frustrating. I mean, where you have politicians who are ignorant and who still deny completely anything about global warming, for example, or that pesticides harm people, you can say, well, you know, they've really wallowed in their own ignorance because in that way they don't offend their patrons. Hmm. But when you have politicians who know better, then you basically say that's because they don't feel there's enough people power organized behind them. And when they reject that organized people power, you got to go into another arena, and that's what we did with trying to build a longer-term political movement beyond November 7th.
Ralph, could I ask, how has all this changed your own life? I've seen how big you are on campuses these days, and yet also people expected you to be a pariah in the Congress and the Capitol in general. What's the truth of it all?
The main change is really a kind of pettiness. When John LaFalce, who worked with me to introduce a airline passenger bill, refuses to do so because of what happened in the election, when John Conyers refuses to have anything to do with any groups that I have anything to do with, and there are other examples, Senator Biden said he better not come up here in the Senate. That is really incredible. These are people who have worked with right-wing Republicans, and they've cut deals in their political careers. and they can't get used to progressive voters having another choice, because they've been telling them via the DLC, Democratic Leadership Council, etc., and they've been telling progressive Democrat voters, you got nowhere to go because we're better than the Republicans, or not as bad as the Republicans. And they can't get used to that. And as Jesse Jackson Jr. Has told them repeatedly, if they don't, they're going to have more defections from the progressive base to Green parties and to other Green parties and other third parties.
Tom Edsel, I wonder, would the Washington Post cover Ralph differently in 2004?
If he were to run?
Yeah.
I mean, I think he would have to show a credible ability to get votes. He'd have to show a credible ability to appeal to a constituency beyond the college campuses. He has argued that he represents the interests of labor and minorities. He'd have to show some ability to get the votes of those people. I'm not sure that he did either his political future or his policy-making future that much good by what he did in 2000.
Lance Morrow.
I'm not sure that he would be given more serious coverage.
Lance Morrow, I wonder, because Ralph speaks of the Bartlett and Steele corporate crime cover in Time magazine. When Time magazine discovers an issue like that, or puts it front and center on its own kind of journalistic agenda, do you look around for a candidate to carry the standard or not? Would Ralph be more interesting or less in another campaign?
Well, I think my guess is that if he were to run next time, he would be more interesting in certain ways. The question about Bartlett and Steele implies that the Bartlett and Steele message was the Time magazine agenda, which is not necessarily the case. I mean, the editors at Time are simply covering week to week, having story conferences, deciding how to cover a particular race. I don't think that there was any decision that, well, Bartlett and Steele have raised this point, let us pursue it in our coverage of the campaign. I would love to know from Mr. Nader what he would consider appropriate coverage. Would he consider that a permanent correspondent should be assigned to his campaign, as we have a correspondent with the Democrat and with the Republican? Is there a special distinction for the third party candidate that is different from, say, let us say, candidates running within the parties, for example, Alan Keyes, Pat Buchanan, Gary Bauer, people like that, who also have coherent agendas, very articulate agendas. Which, I mean, Alan Keyes was very outspoken on a number of important issues. Does he consider that those people should similarly be given full-time coverage? And also, I would raise the point that every news operation is under severe budget constraints during a campaign, now more than ever, and partly because of the corporate stuff that Mr. Nader has talked about.
Do you want to bleed for these big corporations, Ralph Nader? maybe they can't afford to cover you.
Well, now, that's what I'm saying.
Maybe Time Warner is just playing out of reporters.
Maybe they're spending too much time on mergers. They seem to be reporting regular profit increases.
But you don't understand the budgetary process in these news organizations. They get squeezed harder the more corporate shenanigans are going on. In fact, the bureaus close, correspondents get fired, and so on. The news budget gets leaner as these more mergers transpire and as more titles are added to the corporate names.
So, I want to get some more callers in here. Anime is calling from Charlotte, Vermont.
Hi.
Anime, welcome.
Hi. I want to make just two comments. One is that the people who have privilege will never, ever give them up voluntarily. The news media are owned by corporations. stands to reason, you know, that they will push their own agenda. The other thing is that anybody who really rattled the cage in substantial ways, like maybe Martin Luther King or the Wobblies, they all got destroyed. So I'm so glad that Mr. Nader has the courage and the stamina to hang in there and to widen the debate and to say things that really could change the world.
Ralph Teagabau, is it harder than it looks or not?
Well, I mean, just taking off what Tom Edsel said, I mean, there is that catch-22. I mean, I campaigned a whole day in Washington, D.C., and I was the only presidential candidate who's ever campaigned in Anacostia. And it was a really wonderful day. And the Washington Post has all kinds of reporters, and they didn't cover it at all. They weren't even there. I don't want to go into the details of how important our various locations were, but they showed a side of D.C. that presidential campaigns ignore. When Mr. Morrow made his point on, you don't want to push an agenda just because you had a cover story, you know, I was just alluding to that by way of saying that the issues that we raised were not, like UFO issues or whatever. They were issues that the major media themselves recognized as important.
Ralph,
so we didn't have to quibble about the importance of the issues. I mean, Business Week had a cover story saying too much corporate power on September 11th, 2000, and it answered yes and said corporations get out of politics. So, again, I was not dealing with marginal issues. That was the point I wanted to make.
Let's
Chris,
get one more
call. Can I make one point here?
Fast, because I want to get a caller in. Go ahead.
Just that the caller before has referred to Martin Luther King. He got a tremendous amount of coverage because he did mobilize a huge constituency and altered the whole view of the country. Ralph Nader's campaign does not compare to that.
Okay.
It's just not right.
That's for historians, too. The phone is 617-450-2923. Jeff is on the line.
Hi.
Hi,
Jeff. I have a question for Ralph. I'm an activist on University of Pittsburgh campus, and I've noticed a lot of the Democratic Party activists, student activists, speaking with them and always meeting them at different rallies for different causes, that they seem to have a closer agenda with the Green Party than the Democratic Party itself, and yet they're always making excuses, running the same party lines about, the more pragmatic approach to the Democratic Party. I just want to know how we can, as Green Party supporters, get these guys to come over.
Well, if I heard you through the interference, the students have formed a group called Campus Greens. They've incorporated it in January, and they're
proceeding. That's actually one of the groups I'm involved with.
Yeah, and they're proceeding to establish anywhere from 500 to 900 Campus Green chapters around the country. So, and there's a lot of energy, almost reminiscent of the '60s, among Campus Green adherents. So maybe we'll hear more from it in the future.
Okay. Does that do it, Jeff?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Ralph. I wanted to thank you for running this last year.
Thank you.
Lance Morrow, last quick word.
I just wondered if I could ask my question again to Mr. Nader. Is what would be, and I'm asking it quite seriously and simply, what would be appropriate coverage?
That's a good question. Once you clear the primary, because obviously there's so many different primary candidates. Once you clear a primary, you're in the final race, you're down to three or four candidates, and one of them is hovering, 5, 6, 7% in the polls and higher in some key states and has all these other newsworthy criteria. I think it would be good to do what the LA Times and some others did. They would assign a reporter for a week or two, which is more than just a feature.
Right.
And when it really gets close, and if it's going to affect the margin, then you assign more people to it.
Ralph, it's always a pleasure, and thank you very much for joining us for a full hour. Thank you, Lance Morrow. Thank you, Tom Edsel. Thank you, Anthony Lewis, for joining us earlier in the hour. Thanks also to the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School. Thanks to the startup lawyers at the Bingham Dana Law Firm in Boston. Thanks to New England Streaming Media for audio streaming and to Justin Dangle for all-round encouragement. This program was produced in the BMP studios at the Christian Science Monitor by the team of Tom Tiger, Hitesh Hatti, Amy McDonald, Catherine Bidwell, and Jake Shapiro. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Please visit us at www.christopherlydon.org.